Hey now, and welcome to the City Off Campus podcast with your two favorite hosts, Sammy Sommerfeld and Jack McFarland. We've got a special guest today. We've got famous number 12, Hawkeye 12, and Orange Bowl champion, Iowa Hawkeye and former quarterback, Ricky Stanzi. How are you today?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. So my first question for you is, what does being an Iowa Hawkeye mean to you?
Oh, man. Whew, that's a big question. It means a lot. You know, it was such a fun time in my life. From the whole process of getting recruited by Coach O'Keefe and then getting on campus and meeting all of who have now become my best friends and stood up with me at my wedding, and we still get together every year and see each other, and our families are all close. So, you know, and then on top of that, the actual game of football, and we were able and fortunate to have a ton of success while we were playing football there. So there's just so many great memories associated with the university, and it really started with just kind of Iowa being the one Big Ten school that gave me a shot and was, you know, interested in my skill set and was serious about me coming there. And then when I got there, to meeting all my buddies and getting that camaraderie of being on a team, and then we were able to put some good seasons together, and it's just been a wild ride. It was a wild ride then, and it still is now, because people, you know, we're having these conversations and people still cherish those days. And so it was a blast, and it was really a blessing.
Yeah. So what was your recruitment journey like? You just briefly touched on it, but what attracted you to the game of football at an early age, and how did you get into it? And, you know, how did you end up at Iowa?
Yeah. I mean, the sport's been in my life since I can remember. You know, my dad's always been a huge fan of football, and so football was just always around us growing up. And I started playing tackle football in second grade. And I think from that point, I always wanted to be a football player. I obviously played other sports. I played basketball, baseball. I did all sorts of things. But football was always kind of the number one sport in our house. And then, you know, I was fortunate enough to play well in high school to garner some attention. And it was really mostly MAC schools to start. And then, you know, Coach O'Keefe started to show up, and Iowa started to get interested. And then they finally offered. And I was really down to Miami of Ohio and Iowa when it kind of came down to it. And I visited those two schools, and I loved Miami. It was awesome. But going to Iowa and being around that Big Ten atmosphere, and being someone who grew up in Ohio, a Cleveland guy, I liked Ohio State growing up. I watched a lot of Big Ten football growing up. So that was kind of really the selling point. I wanted to be in the Big Ten. I loved Coach Ferentz. I loved Coach O'Keefe. I thought it was the right place for me. I liked the way they did things. And, you know, it was a good decision looking back.
Yeah. So you talk about Coach O'Keefe and Ferentz. What were they like to have as coaches for you? And what did you learn the most from them? And what were they like as mentors?
They were great. I mean, you know, the first thing that kind of comes to mind is demanding. And we were, you know, it was an atmosphere where you had responsibility as a player to give great effort. You had a responsibility as a player to your teammate next to you, and to give great effort so that we could all excel and that you didn't let the next man down. So it was always a team mentality, always a hive mentality. You know, we have the swarm for a reason, because we know that it takes all of us. And so they instill that early on. And, you know, I learned so much about X's and O's from them. I mean, I learned a lot. And coming from high school where everything's kind of out of your hands as a quarterback, the O coordinator takes care of it. You look at the sideline. But when we got to Iowa, it was very, you were the coach on the field as a quarterback. So from an X's and O's standpoint, I owe a lot of the knowledge of the game that I have today to those two men. And then, you know, as a player, I tell people this all the time, but sitting in those, you know, Monday meetings, Tuesday meetings, where Coach Ferentz would just kind of talk to us. And some of it was about football. Some of it was about life. A lot of it was about merging life and football together. And I learned I learned more in those team meetings than I did at any, you know, class on campus, just because of the life lessons. And it's real. It's raw. You know, you're actually going through it. You're either having the joys of a big victory and you're learning how to navigate those joys, or you're having the tough, you know, taste of a loss, and you're learning how to navigate that. And those are real things that you take with you because that's what you meet in real life. You have adversity, you have these great moments, and you're learning kind of how to work through that as a young man. And having someone like Coach Ferentz there to be with you through those moments and to be talking to you for hours on end. I don't know if guys realize how important that is, but me looking back, I've said it to many people, those meetings, those, you know, team meetings where he would just kind of talk to us were some of the most important moments for me as a young man to learn and to grow and to get my mind in the right frame for, you know, the success we were able to have, and then take those lessons and apply them to life and family and the next businesses that you go into as a player once football is all said and done.
Yeah, and you talk about the meetings, so I would like to go into your preparation as a quarterback. What was your routine? How did you go about preparation week to week? What was your process?
Yeah, once I, you know, finally was able to get to the point where I was a starting quarterback, the thing that I always kind of latched onto was film. And I watched a lot of film, and I had a lot of great mentors to help me with that, Coach O'Keefe and Coach Ferentz obviously being the two that stand out. But I also had a guy, David Rye, and he was kind of a young GA at the time, and he had played quarterback at Iowa, and he was just a student of the game. And I remember sitting with him in the off season for hours on end, and him kind of taking the next level deep dive with me on film. And I was starting to learn how to break down a game the same way that a GA would break down a game to put it into the computer and label it. I would sort of go through the same process as a quarterback because it made me look at every single fine detail of each play. I had to label down and distance, you know, where are they at on the field? What coverage are they in? What blitz did they bring? This, and that. And so that was from my junior year to my senior year. And so my junior year, you know, I had more interceptions than I wanted. So I knew I wanted to kind of shore up how I was seeing things out there. And I wanted to, you know, take that next level. And so Dave was a huge help for me mentally and being able to see the film and break it down and kind of take my game to the next level. So for me, preparation was really centered around film study, knowing what we're doing, obviously, but being very well prepared on who are we facing, what is the matchup. And Coach Ferentz runs the ship like an NFL team from a standpoint of how the week goes and how we look at film. So, you know, that was really a big thing for me and something that I try to relay to any young quarterback I talk to, whether it's high school or college, to get your eyes on the tape and watch it over and over again, because those are really mental reps that you can, you know, take in and learn from even when you're not on the field.
You talk about you know, preparation to play and being able to read defenses and stuff. So when you were, you know, under center, what were you thinking when you were looking at defenses, you know, might be, you know, making a last minute change or audible or something? So how did you know to make the right decisions under such tremendous pressure and bright lights?
Yeah, that's part of the preparation. And that kind of goes right back into being around great coaches, Coach O'Keefe, Coach Ferentz. Like I said, they put a lot on the plate of the quarterback from a run check standpoint, a protection check standpoint, things that you don't usually deal with at the high school level, and even some colleges don't deal with it. So for me as a freshman, it was a lot to take in. But as I slowly spent more and more time in the system and started to understand what looks to, you know, run away from, what looks to run into, and all those little things that come with protection and stuff, by you know, year three, year four in the system, you start to go from that looking almost at every single defender and trying to get like each piece together, as opposed to just kind of looking at one big picture and taking in the contour and seeing the shape. And those things come with reps, and that's why the film study was always so good, because you can see a look and it just, you can react. You don't have to think, because you've seen it before, you know what to do in that situation, and you're able to plug in the right play. And I'd be lying if I said it was easy. I remember the first time Coach O'Keefe handed us the checks and alert sheet, might as well have been in Spanish. And so from that point to my final senior year, there was a ton of growth, and I couldn't have done that without a ton of film study and without the help of the coaches and even the GAs and players that are older and helping you out to get you able to get you to that point where you're on the field and you can see it quick and you can react without thinking.
How did you develop your leadership qualities at Iowa, and what did you enjoy about being a leader? And did you ever feel pressure being a leader of the team and having the responsibilities that you just discussed you kind of had?
Yeah, you know, I've always kind of been, you know, I always thought of it as I got to prove it on the field first, right? I got to go out there and I got to play well. If I can't play well and I can't give our team a chance, if I can't rile the troops up with my actions, then my words are kind of going to fall on deaf ears. So for me, it was always about let's get out on the field. Let's play well, let's earn leadership there. And then you become more and more vocal. A big thing for me as a quarterback and how I just have always viewed the position is that, you know, we're the ones that take the responsibility. And so, you know, you, as a quarterback, it's really only the QB and the head coach that get a winning record, wins-loss record, right? So, you know, with that comes responsibility to kind of take it on your shoulders when things don't go well. And I remember, you know, Coach Doyle said to me, you know, the great leaders are going to not look out the window and look for people to blame. They're going to look in the mirror and they're going to always find what can I do better. And so that was kind of, if I had to sum up leadership to me, it's really, I'm just looking in a mirror. I'm trying to make myself better. And through my example, I can bring other people along and we can kind of find the common goal. And our common goal at Iowa was simple. It was, you know, play the next play 1 week at a time, one game at a time, get that victory and then move on to the next.
And speaking of games, you led some pretty memorable moments during your career, such as, you know, to reference like the Indiana comeback at Kinnick when you guys were ranked number 4, which that one's always a fun highlight to watch, and the Penn State comeback too. You know, what was it like for you to beat, you know, those type of teams in those ways, like with Penn State beating a Joe Paterno team? What was the significance for you and how did you overcome deficits? Like, how did you physically drive down the field and how did you mentally like prepare yourself to do it?
Yeah. You know, people have asked me, what's your favorite moment or what was a highlight of Iowa that really stands out? And I always go back to the 2008 Penn State game because we were kind of, that was the year I finally got to the starting position, and me and Jake were kind of going back and forth at the beginning of the year. So it was hard to have, a definite groove early on. But as we got better, as we got going in that season, we got better. And that game was a huge game for us as a group to move into, that status where like, hey, we can play with these guys. And I think that it really speaks to who we are as a unit, as a team, kind of transitioning there at the end of 08 into the 2009 season. In 2009, I just really feel like we didn't think we would ever lose. You know, even no matter what the circumstance was, there was always an upbeat, positive mentality on the sidelines. You know, the Indiana game is a perfect example of that because before the fourth quarter even starts, I've thrown 5 interceptions and I've got my own teammates. Coach Ferentz doesn't look, you know, too worried. My teammates don't look worried. And in most places there'd be a total implosion. Right. And so we were able to kind of, with everything like kind of looking like it's not going to go our way that day, it's the fourth quarter and we're still upbeat. And that really speaks to Coach Ferentz's leadership. And then it speaks to the guys on that team, how we just never felt we were out of it. And I think a lot of that started at that Penn State game when we kind of got that feeling when we're looking around like, hey, we can play with these guys. We can win games. We just have to stay in it together and we have to play all the way to the last whistle.
Referencing the Indiana game, I mean, you overcame, you know, that was such a big game, just that the ending. So there's one play where you kind of roll out of Indiana's end zone and you throw a deep ball for a touchdown. I think it was to McNutt, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
How, like, where do you get the confidence to, you know, you're down by so much, like, you know, it's a risky throw where if it doesn't get to him, gets picked off, the game's basically mm-hmm. done. So where does that confidence come from to make big throws?
Yeah. You know, I think it has something to do with having a short memory, you know, and that's a big thing as a quarterback to kind of, something goes bad early on, you still have to bounce back and you've got, you know, if it happens early in the game, I've thrown pick sixes off the first play. So if you let that get to you, it's going to be a long day. So short memory, and that goes both ways, whether it's good or bad. And that was something I always kind of tried to have just to keep me locked into each play at a time. And that really is kind of sums up that game where, you know, I didn't feel bad throwing the ball. I just felt a little off at times, but I didn't lose the confidence. And I knew that if put in the right position and we give the playmakers a chance, playmakers like Marv and Darrell, we give them the ball in space, they're going to make something happen. And, you know, it was a total team effort. You look at Sash's great interception return down when they're driving. I mean, that was a huge play. So the 2009 team, you know, we had a tremendous defense. We had a tremendous run game. And when we really played complementary football, and that was something that Coach preached a lot. We have to have all three phases working together for us to win games. And so that Indiana game really tested us. But it's, you know, the short memory is something that's crucial for a quarterback. And I kind of developed that as I went, especially in 2009.
Going back to 2009, I have a couple of questions about it. One, so how tough was that defense that you guys would have to go against in practice every day? And how did they help prepare you guys for that season and the success later on? And then the second one is, in all the great seasons of Hawkeye football, now that you can look back at that 2009 and really reflect, where does it rank in all of those great seasons?
Yeah, you know, the first question with the defense was, you know, it was tremendous for us as an offense to go against these guys. I remember times when Kirk had to pull Claiborne and Ballard off the field because they just created so much havoc for us on offense that it was just easier for us to execute our plays without them on the field. So to give you an idea of what it was like, and that pushed our O-linemen and made our O-linemen better. And it pushed our receivers. It made our receiving core better. It made our running backs better. So we were able to kind of test ourselves against one of the best defenses in the nation day in and day out. And obviously we knew what they could do. And then you look at 2009 and their play speaks for itself. The games that we were struggling on offense, they kept us in it. And then when we needed to make big plays, we were able to do it. And then, you know, the second thing about the 2009 season, it's special because of all these moments that we talk about, you know, and the way that the games ended up. I mean, the first game right out the bat, there's two kicks blocked to win the game. And, you know, we're walking off the field and we're 1-0, but at the same time, I'd be lying if I said it felt like a victory, because we probably should have won that game by more. But it was one of those things where, like I said earlier, we just didn't feel like we were going to lose. And I remember at Penn State, it's a whiteout, it's raining, the place is going nuts. And they hit a touchdown pass on their first play. It was like a 68-yarder or something big. And the place is just, I mean, it felt like it was going to fall under us. But nobody was fazed by it at any point during that night. And same thing at Michigan State. You know, they run the old hook and ladder, and then Kirk hits a great pass down the middle, and they score, and we got a minute. Nobody was panicked. You know, you look at the Indiana game and what we just talked about with the five picks and facing a fourth quarter deficit, nobody was worried. And so that's what kind of – I always look back on that 09 team, and this – whatever the adversity was, whatever the situation, whatever city we were playing in, it didn't matter. We were going to play for four quarters, and we were going to play till the last whistle. And that season always ranks with me as really one of my favorite to be a part of, just because it was up and down, it was roller coaster, but it was a hell of a ride. It really was.
So to cap off that season, you guys had an awesome performance in the Orange Bowl that was highlighted with you post-game giving one of the most memorable quotes ever. If you don't love it, leave it, USA number one. Oh, yeah. I got to ask, what was the inspiration behind that quote in that moment?
You know, there's a few things. We were watching a lot of Ricky Bobby at that time at the house. There was a lot of Ricky Bobby going on. So I think we had said, we've been saying love it or leave it. Like, we've been saying it. We've been saying these colors don't run. We were saying all sorts of stuff, just kind of in reference or in a Ricky Bobby voice. And then Chris Myers asked that question, and I really wasn't sure how to handle it. And so I kind of took it a more comedic route and just had more fun with it. And you can kind of see me turn around and look at my buddies after I said it. But, man, if I would have known where that quote would have taken me, I would have still said it, because it was a blast. And people to this day, we still talk about it. I get people, you know, bring it up every 4th of July or whenever the season starts or anything like that. So it was fun, man. It was a great cap to a great season. It was a great group of guys that had a lot of fun playing hard together. And we were able to fight off a lot of what looked like losses, and then for us to go down there and play a good opponent and really control the game and get the victory. It was surreal. It was really cool. And, you know, the quote for me was just kind of me having fun and getting everybody fired up. And my friends loved it, you know, fans loved it. And we're obviously still talking about it today. So it obviously stuck with a lot of people.
Who were some of your teammates at Iowa who had the greatest impact on you?
Yeah, got to go with my guys I live with. I mean, right off the bat, me and, you know, AJ Eads were roommates since freshman year. And we came in together on our recruiting trip. And we kind of really bonded right there. And the second that I remember Coach, somebody was asking, who do you want to room with? They asked randomly. And I was like, oh, AJ. And AJ had said the same about me. So we were buddies since the first time we met. And we roomed together for 2 years. And then we all kind of, our other buddies, Brett Morris and Jeff Tarpinian, we all were in the same grade. And Tony Moyaki was above us. And Colin Sandeman and Andy Schultz, we were all at one house. And Tony was at a different house, but he was at our house so much that he kind of was basically an honorary member of 1021. And 1021 was the street we lived on, and or the house number of the street we lived on. So, you know, those guys are my closest friends, and I still, you know, talk with them quite a bit. I'm actually going to see Brett, Tony, and AJ in Chicago in a couple weeks. So, you know, those guys, we did everything together. You know, you fight together, you bleed together, you win games together, you lose games together, and it just forms a really tight bond. And I remember a lot of the former greats that would come back and talk to us every week when we had an honorary captain or we had a guest speaker, and they would always talk about that. They'd talk about the camaraderie. They would talk about, you know, being on a team and your best friends. And I had known this from high school. I, you know, still had some of my close buddies from high school that I played with. And there's nothing like that camaraderie of being on a team. And it gets even more elevated, and it's probably at its highest in a college setting, because you're away from home, you're with your friends all day, you're with them in the dorms, you're with them at football. And so you form really tight friendships, and you know, those are unbreakable bonds. And then you go through big games and victories and losses together, and it just, your families get tight. And so those guys are my best friends, and we still kick it to this day. And that's really one of the biggest things that I love about Iowa are those guys that I met.
Yeah, that's awesome. What did you enjoy about being a student at Iowa outside of football? What were some of your favorite things about Iowa City or, yeah, you know, things like that?
Yeah, I thought you were talking about school for a second, and I was like, you know, no, I mean, school was great, did what I needed to do, but, you know, I love the campus. I mean, Iowa City, the nightlife, everybody knows that it's a blast, and the way the town's set up, it's real, you know, kind of party friendly. To be honest, when we got there, it was like the bars were 19. So pretty much everybody could go in, and they made a change on that. But it was 19 when we were there, and, you know, you get, take one cab ride down and you're in the heart of the city. And so I love Iowa City. I went back for the Penn State game last year, and still a blast, still had a great time with the guys, and a lot of great memories. And, you know, that campus is beautiful. And I remember a lot of people that when I told them I was going to Iowa, they were like, oh, what, it's just cornfields and farmland and all. And I'm like, I don't really know. I hadn't been there. But once I got to Iowa City, and that was part of the recruiting trip, was I fell in love with the campus. I thought it was great. You know, I thought it was totally off what I probably had expected as just a high school kid in Cleveland, doesn't know anything, barely knows the streets he lives on. So to be in Iowa City and to see the stadium and to go around and to see the campus, you know, I fell in love with it immediately, and I still love it to this day. And you know, the school is beautiful. You know, the businesses around it and the bars and the shops and everybody's pro Hawkeyes. And so it's got a tight vibe to it. And, you know, you can feel that in a night game at Kinnick. If everybody knows what it's like there. And people that I've run into after football, and people that aren't even Hawkeye fans that have had the chance to see a game, they talk about Kinnick. And so it's, you know, people know what they know. If they don't know who Iowa is, once they come to town, they're very well aware of what Kinnick's all about and what Iowa City has to offer.
I wanted to talk about a game in your 2010 season against Arizona. You mm-hmm. touched on briefly earlier about keeping just composure and not letting mm-hmm. things knock you off your course. And one quarterback who's still playing in the NFL today, Nick Foles, is a really strong embodiment of that, especially with this comeback against the Falcons. What did you see in that game in 2010 that indicated to you that he was going to be an NFL quarterback?
Well, I mean, right off the bat, you look at just Nick's size, and he's a big guy. He's all 230. He really is an incredible athlete. After I had left Iowa and I was in the pros, I was with the Jaguars for a little bit, and I had a buddy who had played with him at Arizona. And, apparently Nick's as good of a basketball player as he is football. And so his talent is amazing. His arm talent is incredible. He's got a quick release. He plays fast. He's got a mind for the game. And, you could see it. You could see the way the ball flies out of his hand. You know he's got big arm talent. He was a guy that I think the year before, he was kind of just now working into the starting rotation. And so 2010 was kind of the first time I really got to see him, kind of whip it around. And I think the arm strength stands out, the sheer size stands out, and his ability to fight and to be a guy who can come back. And the dude handles adversity like a total champ. He's been a blast to watch in the NFL. He really has. And I'm not surprised when I turned on the TV on Sunday and I saw him out there running around leading the comeback. It doesn't surprise me at all. I think anybody that's followed him and has seen his character and the way he carries himself and what he's done, not only for the Eagles and what he was able to help bring to the city, but the way he handled adversity in Jacksonville and what he's able to do now, it speaks a tremendous amount to his character. And like I said, everything that I've heard about him from people who coached with him and play with him have nothing but great things to say. And you can definitely see that just by the way he plays and carries himself.
So now, as of recently, you and Nate Stanley are the only two Iowa quarterbacks to lead Iowa to 3 bowl game wins. What does a statistic or fact like that mean to you when you look at, the Hayden Fry era and the other mm-hmm. quarterbacks that played for Ferentz? What does it mean to be one of two quarterbacks to have that accomplishment?
Well, I mean, I'm honored to have the opportunity to even be on the field to have the chance to win 3. And that it gets back to what Iowa football is all about and kind of what I touched on to start everything off. And that goes right into the camaraderie and the team mentality, swarm, and like I had said, the head coach gets a wins-loss record, the quarterback gets a wins-loss record. But, the real reality is that we had good football teams and I was fortunate enough to help lead good football teams. And, it was never one phase that could get it done. And I had a lot of great running backs, had a lot of great O-lines, had a lot of great receivers, had a great defense to help me out and get me out of jams when it was tough. So, I'm honored to, have that as a stat, but it really reflects on our team and the group of guys that we had for those 3 years and what we had tried to build there as youngsters and what we wanted to get done when we finally got our chance on the field. And so I'm just really proud to have been a part of that group, to be able to do those fun things like go to bowl games and win bowl games and have all those great memories with them. So it brings back a lot of fun times, a lot of good memories. And it really speaks to the team atmosphere that is Iowa football.
Transitioning kind of from your college to professional career, starting off, what was it like to take part in the Senior Bowl?
Yeah, it was cool. It was a really cool experience. The whole, I guess you can call it draft preparation, because the Senior Bowl it's like another showcase. And the whole preparation process was grueling, to be honest, but very cool and very interesting to take part in. It's something you grow up dreaming about. And the Senior Bowl was fun. Met a lot of great players, met a lot of good people, got to play against a lot of great competition, guys who are still playing today. And so it was a great memory. And it almost feels like a blur how everything happened so quick at the Senior Bowl, and then you're at the combine, then you're drafted, then you're on a team. So it was one of those moments where there's a lot of hectic things going on, and you're trying to kind of take it one day at a time. But it was an honor to be there first and foremost. And, you know, it was fun to kind of meet new people and play against some of the best competition in the country.
Yeah. Was the combine and draft process like really stressful just in terms of the amount, like what was your training schedule like?
The combine's crazy. Yeah. The combine's crazy. It's, you know, it's 3 days of nonstop. Like you don't get much rest, and they create it that way. You know, it's a 3-day job interview, essentially. You know, it's part of the interview. That they're still gonna look at your tape, and they're gonna want to, you know, do the deep dive on you and talk to coaches and stuff. But it's a chance for them to kind of look at you and do the whole, you know, C test and take a look, a little deeper dive into injury history. You know, you're doing things you don't think that you're gonna have to do, like go get MRIs on your busted ankle and your shoulder, and they're looking at every little thing, and you're doing these, you know, psychological tests, and you're doing these, you know, emotional tests, and you're sitting in the room with, you know, really the top brass of each team, and you got this, and you're going through film, and they're grilling you with questions, and so you're answering a bunch of questions, and you have these, you'll finish an interview, you know, and you're talking to the Jets, and the next thing you know, you're over talking to the Raiders, and it really is surreal, because you're in this, the hotel is, it's in Indianapolis, and it's this kind of open floor plan, so there's just all these rooms that are, it's all the top, it's every team, it's all these guys that you've seen on TV, all the GMs, all the coaches, and you're just walking around there trying to remember everybody's name and remember their offensive type and what questions are they going to ask. And so it was crazy. It's one of those things where I'm glad I got to go through it, but I wouldn't want to do it again. You know, it's just kind of, it's a stressful thing, and they want it to be stressful, but once again, cool process to go through.
What was the craziest question you were asked by a team?
You know, everybody, I see all this stuff every time the draft comes out, all these crazy questions, you know. I didn't really have anything that crazy. I didn't. There was no crazy question. Most of the stuff I went right in, and it was right on, let's turn on the tape. And so we turn on the tape, and it was just a lot of X's and O's talk, like deep dive football talk, like, what are you doing here? What play did you check here? What were you thinking? Why did you do that? You know, they'd pick some good plays, and they'd pick some really bad plays that you had to have a good answer to. And I think a lot of it for them was kind of just, you know, recognition of plays from past, being able to memorize what had happened at that moment and play recognition and being able to recall kind of from your Rolodex of plays that had happened in your career. So I didn't really get any off the wall questions. It was just straight X's and O's on a deep dive level. And going back to what I talked about with Coach O'Keefe and Coach Ferentz, the best part of the combine for me was interviews. I mean, I could talk for days about football because of how well they had prepared me. And I understood the pass protections. Coach Ferentz comes from an NFL pedigree. He understands blitzes and stuff. So I had seen all this stuff. So I really was able to kind of knock that part of the process out of the park.
Yeah. So what was draft day like for you, and what was it like to, you know, get drafted by the Chiefs, to, you know, be under vets like Kyle Orton, mm-hmm. And Matt Castle? What was kind of the whole draft day experience like, and then your tenure there?
You know, the draft day experience was, once again, another surreal thing. My dad had, you know, he'd been having draft day parties for years since I was a little kid. The first round, we'd always have his buddies over, and we'd, being from Cleveland, you get a lot of first round picks. So we had a lot of draft parties. So kind of growing up, it was always like, I want to be in the NFL draft someday. And then there you are, you know, you're there on draft weekend, and you know, you're kind of waiting for your name to be called. And there's, once again, you're in that draft process. There's so much information going through, and you don't know where you're going to go. And, you know, you got a lot of people, a lot of family and friends asking you questions. And, you know, you just kind of want to be left alone for 3 days until somebody calls, and then you're, you know, you're off the hook, and you know where you're going. The Arizona had called me first. So I think Arizona was either a pick ahead or two picks ahead of the Chiefs. And they had called and said, hey, we're getting ready to draft you. I was like, oh, great. And so the next thing I know, another phone call comes in, and that's the Chiefs. And so that was kind of, they had the pick before, or two picks before. And so I kind of was like, oh, sorry. And, you know, kind of had to hang up on the Cardinals. And then next thing I know, I'm on the phone with the Chiefs, and you know, talking to Coach Haley, talking to Scott Pioli, talking to Jim Zorn, talking to, you know, everybody there that's associated with the Chiefs. And then you're on the phone with their media, and then you get out and then you're talking with your family and stuff, and you're getting to know everybody. And luckily for me, Tony Moyaki was on the Chiefs at the time, so I knew somebody. So I had at least somebody on the team that I can kind of, you know, talk to and kind of work my way into the group. But it was also an interesting year because that was the lockout year. So we didn't have a normal off-season process. It was kind of get drafted, and then we just sat around for a few months. And kind of we, you know, Matt Cassel and the leaders of the Chiefs kind of put some stuff together where I was able to go down and kind of, you know, hang out with Tony for a few days while we tried to learn the offense from each other. But it wasn't a usual off-season. We didn't have any OTAs or anything. So it was kind of get drafted, and everybody just kind of sat around, and then we showed up for camp and we were rolling.
In that quarterback room between you, Matt Cassel, and Brady Quinn, everyone's listed at 6'4". Who's actually the tallest? Because I'm sure you guys actually figured this one out.
You know, I think, man, everybody's a little all those stats are just like a little, maybe an inch off or two, but I'd say everybody was at least 6'4", 6'5". And that, thinking back on it, I feel like they were probably, we were more 6'5". And so, you know, I had always been listed at 6'4". And then we got measured one year, and I was a true 6'5". And I was like, oh, sweet. So I don't know if it was the off season of yoga that had kind of stretched me out a little bit. But, you know, everybody was really their true height. I can't say for certain who was taller, but I'll say Brady was taller than I thought he was. Matt was always, you know, he's a big guy, he looked big. But Brady was definitely taller than I thought he was.
What was your welcome to the NFL moment?
Oh, I think it was, man, it's probably like, you know, third or fourth day of camp, and you're the third string guy, and, you know, you're getting maybe like 5 or 6 reps. So you're kind of just like, it's back to freshman year of college football. It's like, just don't mess these few reps up. And I remember coach called some, it was like a basic, you know, 21 personnel, a basic two back fake. And you come up and there's a seam route and then a dig. And I remember I threw a pick to Kendrick Lewis, who was actually my roommate on the road and great dude. But I had like no idea where he was and where he had came from. And these guys were so good at disguising coverages in the NFL. And they could, you know, they could get down low and play with you and then jump right out and get underneath the seam or underneath the dig. And so that was kind of my first, like, I get back there, I'm going to throw it, boom, pick. And I was just like, you're in front of fans now, because you're, you know, and you got people yelling, you suck, fans. You know, like, oh, man, this is intense, you know. And it's like, I'm just trying to kind of get the offense, like just barely get it, you know, just enough to where I can, you know, go in there and put at least 4 reps together. And that was kind of the first, it was early on in camp. You're trying to adjust to a new scheme. You don't really know anybody on the team. And I go out there on first play and I throw a pick and I'm just like, oh, man, here we go. And so, you know, back to what I said before, short memory, strap it in and just look to try to get better on the next play. But that was kind of the moment where I was like, all right, like gotta figure this out. Gotta get it dialed in. These guys play fast and aggressive up here.
Who were some guys in the NFL you learned the most from, or you consider mentors, whether they're coaches or players?
Yeah. Man, there's a lot of great people that I was around, you know, kind of off the bat. The room that sticks out a lot is it's my third year. So I had 2 years in Kansas City. And then my third year, there was a regime change. And that's when Andy Reid came in. And so it's Andy Reid. Alex Smith was the starter, Chase Daniel, me, and then Tyler Bray was the undrafted guy. But in the quarterback room at the time, we would have meetings with Andy Reid, Doug Peterson, who was the O coordinator, and then Matt Nagy's our quarterback coach. So I'm sitting in the room with these three coaches that just phenomenal, like they just know the game. I mean, they you know, Matt and Doug played the position, so they were like really cool, really chill. It was like having two older quarterbacks in the room with you, and like you could kick it with and you could really have like locker room talk with them, and they were just kind of like one of the guys. And then you got the GOAT Andy Reid sitting in there, and you know, he's kind of like the grandfather, and he's kind of, you know, when he comes in, we just kind of stop and listen to whatever he would say. And Coach Reid could coach any position on the field. So you're in this room, and you got, you know, I'm just quiet. I'm just sitting there listening. I feel like a rookie all over again. Me and Brayden, I'm not saying anything. And, you know, you're learning from Alex Smith. You're learning from Chase Daniel. You're learning from Matt Nagy, Doug Peterson, and Coach Reed. And so that was a really cool experience to be around those guys for a little bit and just see how they operated. Because, you know, we struggled the first 2 years in Kansas City, and it was hard to get momentum. And then to see how Andy ran things and the way he ran the ship, it was very apparent to me. I'm like, Chiefs are going to be good. You know, I got cut by the end of that training camp, but I had known at that point, I'm like, this guy's a pro. Coach Reed is an absolute pro. Everything they say about him is true. He's the nicest guy in the world. He works so hard, and I was stoked for him to see him get the Super Bowl win. But that was a big room. I was with Dan Orlovsky and Matt Stafford in Detroit. Dan's doing a phenomenal job now as an analyst, and I'm not surprised that he's an analyst because he was just as good. He was doing what he's doing now as a job in the room with us as a backup quarterback. And then Matt Stafford's preparation was phenomenal. You know, he was a guy who was seemed like he was there at 4 a.m. and didn't leave till, you know, 8 p.m. And he had an absolute, you know, cannon for an arm, had all the talent and really understood the game. And so it was cool to be in that room. And then kind of the other big room that I was in was with, you know, the Giants for a camp with Eli Manning. And so to see Eli, and it's interesting because Eli's kind of, he's a little more reserved, a little bit more quiet, but, you know, this guy's a Super Bowl MVP. And so, you know, he's got a couple of rings. So to be around him was a nice little change of pace, and he was a real cool guy to be around. So I was able to be in some pretty cool rooms and learn from some great guys who are who had great careers and who are, you know, still doing it right now and have got their chances as starters or as coaches.
Were there any major differences you noticed being in quarterback rooms with, you know, guys, you know, on the Chiefs, the Giants, you know, the Lions, and then you go to places like the Jags and the Browns? Was there a huge drop off? Like what were, like, you know, teams like the Jags and Browns like when you were there, and what were the biggest similarities or differences?
It's a good question, because I think on the outside, when you're looking in at the NFL and you see the records and you see just – you only get to see Sunday, really. And that's changing now with, you know, the access and all that. But for the most part, the difference between 16-0 and 0-16, it's so slim. Like, there's just so little room for air. And the general way of preparing is kind of the same all around. You know, everybody's watching film all day. And so I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a huge drop off, but you know, when you're in a room where the chain of command, the communication is all seamless, it's very controlled, it's understood what we're trying to do. That's kind of back to what I talk about with the Chiefs and Andy Reid. And you know, I never felt like that wasn't something that was going on in any other facility. You know, one of the tough situations we had was when I was in Detroit, my last year in the NFL in 2015, you know, Joe Lombardi got fired in the middle of the year, and he was kind of our old coordinator and our QB coach. So it was a tough situation to go through as a team, because you just have this crazy change right in the middle, and now you're a new offense and you've got, you know, new coaches showing up and changing, you know, who coaches where. So there was, you know, those situations happen. Like I said, the difference between 16-0 and 0-16, I know it seems crazy, but it is very small. And everybody's there trying to win. Like, that's one thing I can't iterate enough, is that everybody works real hard at what they do in the NFL. Most of the coaches, they don't leave. Like, I'm not kidding. They have air mattresses in the room, and they're going to go to sleep there, and they're going to wake up, and they're just going to keep watching film. So the amount of dedication at that level is it's admirable. And you know, it is something that carries over into each organization. And it is kind of just it's a revolving door, in a sense that, you know, coaches will go to one team, get fired, or, you know, regime change, and then they'll show up somewhere else. And they're just, you know, you never know where you're going to be. You never know which relationship is going to matter. And so you're always trying to act professional, and you always, you know, think of it as you got a camera on you. So, you know, you can tell when a tight ship is being run like Coach Reed. And then you do have that feeling when things are kind of starting to slip away, and it's hard to just, like I talked about with Iowa, it's hard to get all three phases to go. And, you know, those years are tough. Losing football games is not easy. It's hard to go through no matter what level you're at, especially in the NFL when the seasons are long.
We just kind of talked about your NFL experiences. So you kind of talked about the differences between, you know, a team like the Chiefs, you know, going 16-0 and 0-16. What was the difference between the NFL and the CFL for you? What were the biggest differences there?
CFL is pretty cool. I will say that. It's a really cool league. It's an amazing game. And it was all new to me. You know, I don't know what – I'd be lying if I said I even had an idea what the CFL was before I went up there. And the game itself, the X's and O's, is wild. It's a crazy adjustment. I mean, I'm like 30 years old at the time. I'm like a 30-year-old rookie. I'm trying one last gasp. And I'm out there now, and it's like a whole new operating system. You know, just adding one more body to the defensive side really throws a wrench in it, because you've got a normal, so like I talked about earlier, a normal frame that you go out and you see these contours, you see these shapes, you see these defense that you've seen your whole life. Now they're new. They're similar, but they're really different. And then you add the real change up, which is the motion. Because now everybody's in motion. They're crisscrossing the formation. They're getting downhill runs. So your guys are moving around, and that's fine and dandy, but the other guys are moving around. So you got all these bodies just kind of moving in space in front of you, and you're trying to time up the motion and clap your hands and do it. And I was just, it was a lot at once. Fortunately for me, I was with a great organization, the Calgary Stampeders, who are kind of been like the Patriots of the CFL in the last decade. And I was fortunate enough to be in the quarterback room with the best QB in the CFL, Bo Levi Mitchell. I think he's still the best quarterback in the CFL. And watching him prepare, one of the smartest guys I've been around. Very easily one of the smartest guys I've been around. Very cerebral, understands the game, has a huge arm, plays with a chip on his shoulder, fearless leader, all the things you want in a quarterback. And what was really great about that experience was that we won a lot of games. And so it was a lot of fun to win. And it's a great city. Calgary's beautiful. Canada's beautiful. There's a lot of beautiful towns that you get to go visit and play football in and hang out in. And it's just a little bit more relaxed. Like, it's just a little – the money's not as intense up there. So guys are a little bit more chill, and the off-season program isn't really a thing. So it's just kind of like – it's the NFL talent. I'll tell you that. Like, there's a lot of guys that could be playing on Sunday up there. The game is fast in the CFL. It was just like a little bit more chill, and it was really a blast. It was a pretty cool experience to end my career on.
So anybody familiar with your social media knows that you've been tweeting a lot about I'm gonna pronounce it Gota. Is that how you pronounce it?
You got it.
Okay.
Gota.
And then as well as IABL training, can you just go in a little in about this, because I was trying to make sense of any of it, and I really feel like I need you to translate it.
Yes. So when we say Gota, we are saying the greatest of all time actions. When we say WOTA, we're saying the worst of all time actions. Inside ankle bone low is the IABL. Inside ankle bone high is what we train. And so the Gota system is reverse engineered from thousands of hours of slow motion video. So the founder or the first observer of this system, because nothing's created, we're just observing patterns in slow motion, and then we're reverse engineering a training system off of it. So the first guy that looked at it was Jose Bosch, and Jose, Coach Gilly, as we call him, he was a guy who, you know, he's a businessman who had become independently wealthy, but in the process of growing up and lifting a bunch of weights and trying to be a strong guy, he wrecked his back. He had three levels of degenerative disc. So he kind of went on a journey to heal himself. And in that process, he went through sort of this, you know, corrective exercise, certification process, and had multiple doctors that he worked with and learned things along the way. And he finally met Pete Egoscue, and Pete got him out of pain and kind of got him moving again. But, you know, Gilly knew something was missing. And then in 2011, when the iPad came out, he was finally able to take that that camera and put it up to the TV, and he was able to have access to the, you know, the YouTube glossary of videos. And this is where he started the journey of Goda, which was starting to watch the indigenous cultures, the hunter gatherers, in slow motion to see how they move. So Goda was originally called primal wisdom theory, because it was all about how does the baby move? How does the crawling baby move? And how do the indigenous cultures move? So by watching the indigenous cultures, watching the crawling babies, Gilly noticed there was a pattern that it was emerging. And then he saw that same pattern in Michael Jordan. And that was really, really like clicked for Gilly, because he was like, I'm watching Michael Jordan do something. I'm watching the indigenous do something. And I'm watching the crawling baby mimic the same pattern. So he kept looking, and he saw the same pattern in the 70 plus age groups at the Penn World Championship, relays. And he's like, you know, you got the full life cycle here. You got the crawling baby. You've got, you know, this decade plus super freak athlete. And then you have these people that are able to compete without physio tape on, all moving in a similar pattern. And the opposite pattern is what we talk about with inside ankle bone load training. Because the next thing that Gilly did was he's looking at all the ACL and Achilles shreds in slow motion. And he's seeing a pattern over and over again, inside ankle bone low. So every Achilles shred happens, or an ACL shred happens, when that inner ankle bone that you can put your hand on, that bony landmark that you can feel right down there on the inside, that bony landmark drops past even. And the athlete's now using the inside of the foot to create their pivot off of. That's the air that is damaging the ACL and damaging the Achilles. And so when we say inside ankle bone load training, we're essentially saying that the map, the foundation that the performance industry was built off of, is the wrong map. They're training inside ankle bone low, right? Inside ankle bone low is essentially you using your lifting engine, right? And so we have a world where now we have all this lifting derivatives, and what we do as training is really just lift, lift, lift. But if you're looking at the indigenous and you're understanding what is this body designed to as it pertains to nature, that's locomotion. And then if you look at sports, you realize that sports aren't even lifting, they're all locomotive. So football, basketball, all the sports we grow up to know and love are all locomotive sports, and we're leveling up the lifting engine, which is getting athletes to use the wrong side of their foot, essentially. To boil it down as simple as I can, athletes are using the inside of their foot to drive force forward. They're pivoting off the inside of their foot when they should be pivoting off the outside of their foot. And so our system's all centered around using slow motion video to decode or decipher what I see in the athlete as they travel through space. Do they have a movement error that needs to be fixed? Are they at risk? And then we've got a system to train the good behavior, the go-to behavior, into the nervous system. And so, you know, that process of getting to where I am now with teaching Goda, that started for me back in 2011 when I left Iowa, because my own body, there was something missing. I didn't know what it was, and I'd searched for 10 years until I found Gilly to know what it was. But that was what I was looking for. I wanted to understand, how does movement happen? How do we throw the football? What is exactly going on at the moment of release, right? How do I walk? How do I run? How does that take place? And it was just a passion that, for me, it was just trying to stay on a roster. I was struggling. I wasn't playing well. And every time I got cut, I deserved to be cut. And it just kept pushing me further and further to understand movement better and with more clean lens. And it just over time became a passion for me. And it just, it didn't stop, and it kept rolling. And, you know, one thing led to another that led me to talking to Coach Gilly. And being a slow motion system, and me being someone who has spent his whole life watching slow motion tape to learn football, it was a really easy transition. I was finally able to stop reading books about biomechanics. I was able to pick up my iPad, which I'm comfortable with, and just watch movement in slow motion. And so now we've got a system. I'm one of the, you know, main professors of the system. We just got back from, 2 weekend, lab weekend, as we call it, where coaches come down and we train these new coaches in the system. And so that's what I'm up to now. I'm, helping train the new coaches that come into the movement system. And then I'm training athletes of all ages, different sports, whether it's online or here in Cleveland.
There's been a lot of ligament and soft tissue injuries this year. Would you attribute this to people using the wrong side of their foot? And like you just 100%. Like basically dumbed it down to, And then 100%. with the second part being, I'm pretty sure on your Twitter as well, you have a video of Saquon Barkley doing a power clean, and you reference the specific lift, the power clean, as being one of those lifts that trains athletes to essentially land the wrong way.
Yep.
When is there going to be a change in how these athletes train? Because me personally, growing up when I was in football, a lot of people think of the power clean as a really explosive workout that can help you move momentum in one direction, while in reality it's harming you in the long run. Where do you see the change taking place, if any, in the future?
Yeah, you know, you look at the NFL and what's happened this season, and I am not surprised in the slightest. Me, Gary, and Gilly, and Cody, we were talking about this before the season started, because if you look at how things have been set up with really no OTAs, these athletes are spending more time with their WOTA coach, their trainer, their elite trainer in the off season. And we know what these guys do. We see it. It's all over Instagram and Twitter. It's all the lifting engine derivatives. It's all this fake blueprint that they came up with from studying cadavers. You know, a lot of the stuff that they tell you with movement of keep your spine straight, hold neutral, triple flexion extension, tripod foot. When you turn on the tape, none of that happens. None of it. It's all pivot points. It's all spirals. It's pressure wave energy systems is what we teach, right? So that pivot point energy system that is the hurricane, that is the tornado, the swell in the ocean, that's you. That's how you move. And so the real error comes down to, like I said, to boil it down, if you just think about the leg, just to kind of take the upper half out and to make it simple, if you've got your foot, which is really a half dome arch, and it's sloped to the outside edge, so you have an arch there, you don't want to collapse the arch. You want to move the pressure off the outside edge of your foot. And if you look at your shin bone, which is really your ankle engine, just think of a gyroscope there, and then you go one more bone up and you got your thigh bone, that's your hip engine. So I take those two bones and they create torque. So they turn out, they turn in. The big error is this: people are collapsing the arch and they're using the inside corner of the foot, the big toe corner, to create this pressure wave. So they're starting with the shin and the thigh inward, and then they try to snap the thigh and the shin out, which is exactly the process of a deadlift, of a power clean, a hang clean. Anytime you pull from the ground, pull from the thigh, or you do a heavy drive out of the hole, anytime you engage the lifting engine, you train the nervous system to use that pattern when it's time for max neural drive. So you have these athletes, when you go watch Saquon Barkley's tear or Joey Bosa's tear, they put the inside of their foot into the ground with the shin and the thigh turned in. And then on a contact scenario, they get pushed and the inside of the foot is stuck. So that shin bone's stuck, but the thigh bone keeps going out, and that's shredding the people's knees. So it's shredding their knees in a contact scenario, or it's shredding their knees in a non-contact scenario, which is somebody puts their foot in the ground on the inside edge, the shin and the thigh are turned in. They try to turn the shin and the thigh out, but because they're on the wrong side of the foot and they collapse that arch, the shin gets stuck, but the hip keeps going. And so the fundamental error is you're in a body that's default iOS is forward drive. Like, your eyes are in front for a reason. You're going forward, right? The glute is the biggest muscle in the body because it's on the backside and you're driving force forward. It's like a rear wheel drive propulsion system. So we are built to locomote. Locomotion is inside ankle bone high. If you think of my wrist bone here as the inner ankle bone, I don't want to be dropped down low. I want to be inside ankle bone high. If you put your hands on the ground, you know you want to be inside wrist bone high. You don't want to put the pressure to your index and your thumb. It's the same concept at your foot level. So we want to be the opposite of the lifting engine as we go to run on the football field, basketball court, tennis, it doesn't matter. I want my inside ankle bone high, and I want that shin bone and thigh bone to turn out as I'm landing. That protects me from the ACL shred. Now I can take that thigh bone and shin bone and turn them in. And when I start out and then move in, I'm safe. I'm safe. I can't tear the ACL or the Achilles that way. But if I land inside ankle bone low and the thigh and shin are turned in, then I go to turn out. That's when I'm essentially playing Russian roulette. I'm playing Russian roulette with the ACL. I'm already landing outside of the security system. So over time, I'm beating myself up. But this is why you're seeing these Achilles and ACL shreds. And it changes when people realize that the slow motion video is the way to, it should be the new medium of how we train our athletes. We should be observing our athletes on a day-to-day, seeing where their movement errors are, what they need fixed, and then we should develop a plan to go about fixing them. So we have the system. Like, GOTA's ready to go to the world and is in the process of going to the world to tell people that, hey, we can eliminate the ACL and the Achilles epidemic and the joint replacement epidemic down the road, not even talking athletes, just general population. But like any natural revolution, we are facing a lot of people that are obviously trying to protect this old, you know, institutional academia blueprint that is being proven wrong by the slow motion video. And so we just keep banging the drum. We keep showing the slow motion evidence. We keep having the tough discussions, and we keep going around just kind of like we call it the red pill, just red pilling people one at a time, groups at a time, showing them the, really the red pill on movement. Like, hey, what they taught you about brace your core and triple flexion extension, and you got to lift these weights. It wasn't right. It wasn't. They were wrong. They weren't trying to hurt people. I'm not saying people are trying to hurt people, but the slow motion video shows us that if I go watch 100 ACL and 100 Achilles shreds in slow motion, the mechanism is the exact same every single time. And that should be very alarming to people. And then I go and I talk to the alphabet soup doctors, and they literally train in the pattern of the injury that I talked about. So the way that this is the biggest problem is they studied WOTAs, right? So they studied us, bunch of sedentary humans that sit around all day and don't have to hunt and gather. Well, if you study the regular population that's affected by sedentariness, you're going to get the wrong blueprint. You're going to get the WOTA blueprint. So people have been teaching off of us, the sedentary human, when we should have been doing what the indigenous are doing. We should be teaching the natural way, the baby's way. How does a baby move when it's closest to the source? Well, it moves like the indigenous. So our whole program is based on getting us back to nature's way, bringing you home, as we like to say. And when we do that, we take the ACL and the Achilles shred right off the table.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So my final question for you is, what is advice you'd give to current and future Hawkeyes?
The first thing I'd say is enjoy it. You know, enjoy it. It goes fast. It's cliche. You hear it all the time. But those guys are so dialed in. I know where they're at because I've been there, and they're so focused on their task at hand and being the best player that they can possibly be that sometimes you just don't look up. And next thing you know, you're out of there. So first thing I'd tell them is, you know, enjoy your time there. Cherish your friendships. You know, stay close with the guys on the team, and never lose the Iowa way, which is really the swarm. And that's, you know, we're in this together. We're in it one play at a time, one week at a time, one game at a time. And that always serves us well. And, you know, I'd also tell them to every meeting that they have with Coach Ferentz, cherish that, get the notebook out and write that stuff down that man is saying, because those are some of the best life lessons that you'll ever learn.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. And we just want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it. I mean, for me, growing up an Iowa fan, I'm from Florida, but my family went to Iowa. So growing up, you were the quarterback I grew up on watching, and you were the first Hawkeye quarterback I followed. So this was a really fun podcast for Jack and I, and we appreciate awesome. You coming on. And Jack, you want to close out the podcast?
Yeah. All right, guys, you know the deal. Not the same time, same place. We will see you guys later.